Hello and welcome to an instalment of History Hack's African American History Week. We're thrilled today to welcome Annette Gordon-Reed, who is an American historian and law professor. She is currently at Harvard University, but mostly she is known for her brilliant work in challenging scholarship on Thomas Jefferson regarding his relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings, and her children. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for History and the National Book Award and 15 other prizes in 2009 for her book, The Hemingses of Monticello. Annette, hello and welcome.
Hello, good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming and joining us. Just for our listeners, two-thirds of them aren't American. So very briefly, we know that Thomas Jefferson is a colossal figure in American history and a former president. Where does he fit in and why is he so important?
Well, he's important because he wrote the American Declaration of Independence, which included words, universal language to the effect that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And those words have moved from the context of the separation from Great Britain to be a statement of principle. And it is supposed to be, is considered to be the American ideal, not the American reality, but the ideal, the thing we should be striving for. So in putting those words out there, he has become a focus of lots of attention. He's always been a focus of lots of attention.
Monticello is his home, isn't it? Where is it?
Monticello is just outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. And it's on a little mountain, as the name implies. And it's a place that he sort of made famous by living there, but also founding the University of Virginia, which is in Charlottesville proper.
So if we start with Elizabeth Hemings, because she's the first, she's the oldest member of the family to come to Monticello, but how did she come to be there?
Well, Elizabeth Hemings was an enslaved woman who was owned by a man named John Wales. John Wales' daughter, Martha, married Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. And when John Wales died, the Hemings, Elizabeth Hemings and her children became the property of Thomas and Martha. The interesting twist on this is that John Wales and Elizabeth Hemings had six children together. So Martha brings essentially her half siblings, her mixed race half siblings, enslaved half siblings, to live with her at Monticello with Thomas Jefferson. And that's how their saga at Monticello begins around 1773.
And so to that end, they're never treated like any other slave family, are they? They're a cast apart, if you like, because of the relations.
Because of the connection to Martha, yes. They are treated differently than other enslaved people at Monticello. They're still enslaved, but they are the men in the family go off and work on their own, and they keep their own money. Lots of times Jefferson doesn't know where they are. The women do things that women of the time would be doing, cooking, domestic things, not going out into the fields. So they were kept separate. They were treated differently than other people.
Does that make a difference when it comes to a desire for freedom? Does that mean that they don't
relish
the thought?
It doesn't make a difference at all. Not at all. I mean, Robert Hemings is freed in the 1790s. He's the eldest of the children, of the Wales Hemings children. And James Hemings is freed. None of the women are formally freed, but they desired freedom. Mm-hmm. And that is, that was always a part of it, of the sort of hope that would happen. And Sally Hemings's children, by an agreement between their parents, were freed when they were 21. So freedom was always the goal, an important thing.
So if I'm not mistaken, Jefferson advocated, he was against slavery, but he advocated sending freed slaves to Africa. Is that right? And one of the things he feared or wrote he thought would be an issue was interracial mixture, I think he termed it. But the evidence suggests, doesn't it, that a sexual relationship began between Sally Hemings and Jefferson after 1787. Can you tell us what we can say about it using historical evidence?
Well, the consensus at Monticello and the consensus that I arrived at through my research and other historians, most historians accept now, is that when Jefferson was in Paris with Sally Hemings, they began a relationship, a liaison, whatever you want to call it, and that resulted in, over the span of 38 years, 7 children, 4 of whom who lived to adulthood. Now, this is the complicated situation, because you remember what I said before about Martha and her half-siblings.
Yeah.
This means that Sally Hemings and Jefferson's wife were half-sisters. Mm-hmm. And according to the Hemings family women, on her deathbed, Martha made or asked Thomas not to remarry because she did not want stepmothers for her children. And he was 39 at the time, and he never married again. He died at 83, and he never married again. So this is the complicated situation that
yeah.
sometimes happened in slavery, and it makes, what makes the whole connection between these people fascinating. How do you have your siblings, your blood siblings, in slavery, even if you're treating them differently? You know, what is that all about? How do they talk to one another? What was the nature of their relationship? So that's a part that people always ask me about, and we'll never really know that, but it's mm-hmm. enough to see that this is the sort of complications that were involved with this.
Yeah, they're really not unique, are they, in this scenario either?
No, they're not. They're not at all. These kinds of connections, even rape. I mean, things that are, you know, not even having 7 kids with somebody, but just sort of having a kid or casual connections, and rape were endemic to slavery. Mm-hmm. During that time period. So it's not just him. It's just that it's interesting with him because, or people focus on it because he was a president, right?
Yeah.
He's an important figure, but this was not uncommon.
So she's 14 when they go to Paris, and this is, mm-hmm. he's a minister there, isn't he? So it's like a relocation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. By the time she's 16 and it's time to return, she's pregnant. He gives him an ultimatum, doesn't she?
Yes. Well, she comes over, Jefferson goes over in 1784, and she comes over in 1787 with his youngest daughter. She's supposed to be the companion to the younger daughter. Mm-hmm. And when they get ready to go back in 1789, she doesn't want to go back because she had the chance, she and her brother, she was there with her older brother. This was not just she and here. She was with her older brother who's 24 at the time. They could have taken their freedom in France. Everybody who petitioned for freedom in France in the 18th century, the petition was granted. And she doesn't want to go back because she thinks that, well, she will be re-enslaved. And if she has children, any children she has in Virginia would be enslaved. And Jefferson convinces her to come home with him because he says she will have a nice life at Monticello, and that, and most importantly, any children they have would be freed when they were adults. They would stay with her during their childhood, and then when they got to be 21, they could go. And on that promise, she decided to come back with him. And she did, and lived at Monticello until Jefferson's death, then leaves and moves into Charlottesville after that, and stays with her sons until her death in 1835.
I think you mentioned it before about there's nothing of their relationship from them, is there, that survives that would tell you the nature of it?
Nothing that tells you the nature of it. People talk about them. He is connected to the children. All of the children are named for his best friends and favored mm-hmm. relatives. They are treated differently than other enslaved children. He's not treating them like, you know, like they're legal, like legitimate kids, obviously.
Yeah.
As between the two of them, there's nothing. I mean, the story from her side of the family is that, you know, that I'm quoting this person, mm-hmm. it's one of their grandchildren, Mr. Jefferson loved her dearly, but they don't talk about what she felt about him.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about him, how he's, what he thought about her.
I think, I suppose the big question is, and it means it's open to constant conjecture, is
constant conjecture, because you can see her
blackmail or quid pro quo, even if she was like, if it was like, well, I know I'll have a nicer life and my children would be free, and or was it love? It's a big age gap again, which I think would make people leap towards exploitation, wouldn't it? That 30.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, it's the kind of, I mean, women made, what was a woman's life in the 18th century but your children?
Yeah.
And hoping that the person you were attached to, the man you were attached to, was going to treat you okay and things would work out. Yeah. And wanting to come back to America to be with your family, you know, it's difficult. That was a dilemma that enslaved people, even in the United States, faced. Do you run off and pursue freedom on your own, or do you stay with your mother and your siblings and your sisters and so forth? So it was, I mean, there are lots of reasons that she would come back with him, and lots of reasons she would think, well, you know, he's done, he's going to do what he says he's going to do. She believed, that's a tough thing to think of someone to trust. He did. He ultimately he did, but that was a huge risk on her part.
But you've already mentioned, so the children do get special treatment. They're given names that would show that you don't name after family members and your best friends if you don't hold these children in high regard, do you? And he does keep his pledge about their freedom, doesn't he?
He has his own sense of responsibility about them. I mean, he puts them on, the men, the boys, under the tutelage of his best artisan, who was another of Sally Hemings' brother, John Hemings. And Jefferson worked, I mean, he was sort of a woodworker himself. So he sort of arranged their lives so that he would be in their lives in a way, but there are no letters. There's nothing, the kinds of things that historians look for. To Madison Hemings, the one of the sons, says that he was kind to everybody, but he wasn't like an affectionate father, you know, like bouncing him on your knee or anything like that. But he was uniformly kind, is what Madison Hemings says about him, but not the kind of paternal thing that you expect from a father. But this is a weird
this is one of those things where you want a diary to turn up, don't you?
Exactly.
hidden in a chimney somewhere.
It never will. But you gotta figure this kind of thing happened in England too, between servant girls and the lord of the manor,
my great grandmother. She just get routinely into the workhouse to drop another kid, and she wasn't married, and then another and another. So, yeah, we don't know who the fathers were. She was a domestic servant, so I don't know, go figure, but we'll never know. I mean, like, she was probably illiterate. That's not going to come out in, no chimney diary for me either. Well, but, yeah.
DNA, perhaps. But yeah. that's what that got involved here. No, we don't know the nature of these things, and we don't know that people have the kinds of expectations that we do. I mean, this notion of love and the way that we think about it is not, I mean, even if you look at marriages where people, I mean, Jefferson comes back from Paris and his next door neighbor and kinsman is 50, marries a 17-year-old girl who did not want to marry him, but her parents made her marry him. She would have been in love with someone else, and they were trying to get her away from him. So they marry her off to this 50-year-old.
One of my things at the moment is writing about royal marriage, and it's just like you have to suspend your understanding of what love and marriage is and know that this was a business arrangement, and that we were more business partners, and it was great if you got along than being like open to fall in love with whoever you wanted. And it's like you said, is her choices in life as a woman are either have children with Thomas Jefferson and see them treated well the way they were and eventually freed, or have children with what her other options, another slave if she wants a family, and then of course it would be very different for her children, won't it?
Yes. No, I mean, her kids have, and I talk about this in the book, they have an over 40-year head start on emancipation. And Eston Hemings, you know, we're looking at doing some research. He's at, you know, a couple of years after Jefferson dies, he's at an estate sale somewhere buying silver, silverware. And other people are, I mean, you know, it's, you feel sorry for people who were left in the situation of slavery, but for them, and these are people too, who are nearly white, And yeah. Esten, a couple of them, three of the children eventually leave the African-American community to live as white people.
So Elizabeth and, was mixed race, wasn't she?
Yes, yes.
And then Sally in turn was mixed race as well.
Mm-hmm. So she's what they would have called a quadroon. We don't use those terms anymore, but she's a quarter black. And so three of her children live as white people, and two of them, the two eldest, who go off immediately to live as white people, we don't know anything about their descendants because they evidently changed their names. They married white people. We do know they married white people, and they blended into society and left slavery and Monticello and all of the second class status of or third, fourth class status of
yeah.
of black people behind. So this is, it's a very, very poignant and complicated situation. And we, mm-hmm. as we try to sit back and think, well, what, you know, what should she do? I've had people say to me, well, you know, she should have, you know, found a partner, you know, Stephen Francis found a partner of her own race in a way, another mixed race person. Well, yeah, but we don't know, again, you know what options are open to people at the time, and our categories are not their categories.
No, and their relationship. I mean, at one point, she may not be the acknowledged companion of him, but he's a president of the United States while this relationship is going on, a two-term president, isn't he?
Absolutely.
So telling her that she should just pack the kids up and go and find someone her own yeah. color seems to be immensely dense. I don't know if it's just yeah. me, but it's
yeah. No, it's not. Yeah, no, that's the thing. At some point when they come back, from France in 1789, and they're there in the 1790s, and his political career takes off. He becomes president. And then this situation is revealed. And one of the reasons people did not believe the story was true, historians later on, is because he has two more children with her after this is over. I mean, after this story breaks, I should say.
Yeah.
And people said, well, he wouldn't do that. You know, that would be really dumb to have two more kids with this person after you have been revealed. And so therefore this is not true. Now that's obviously it's a non sequitur, but you, by the time this story is revealed, they would have been living together for 12 years.
And if they've already had five children who are
Exactly.
Black. And what's two more in a world where there's no DNA, no cameras, no mass media, no Twitter?
And I don't think Monticello was Jefferson's home. It was his kingdom. And that argument never struck me because from everything that I knew about reading about him and studying him, nobody on the outside was going to tell him how he lived at Monticello. So and he I guess I'm not going to have any more. Sally, you and I, we're done because
people are
watching.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. I mean, it's an estate. It's not like someone's looking over your garden fence, is it? I mean, if you live in that local area, are you going to want to piss off Thomas Jefferson? No. But just you'd keep your mouth shut, wouldn't you? And it's like you say.
But they did. Actually, they did. They talked about them. But I don't think he cared. I mean, you know, it was like this was not. I mean, from his perspective, again, just from everything, the way he talks about privacy, the way he talks about, not in this context, but just in general, his personal life was separate from his life as a public man. We don't see that now.
No, people just can't tally their heads with that, can they?
No, he says, look, you know, at one point someone asks him, who wants to do a biography of him, he asks him the name of his grandchildren, and he says, why do you need to know the names of my grandchildren?
Yes.
It has nothing to do with my life as a public man. And that he saw those two things as separate.
It's probably just about before the advent of the like mass press and like cheap literature that you could get away with that to an extent, wasn't it? Just about the end of it before really you had no hope of remaining private outside of when you were doing your work. But let's just round off with what becomes of Sally.
Okay.
So she outlives him by a long way, doesn't she? Because obviously
not a long way, just about not a long way, about 11 years.
Oh, really? I thought it was longer than that.
No.
But she moves in with one of her children, doesn't she, in Charlottesville?
Yes. After Jefferson dies, she moves into Charlottesville with her two youngest sons who were freed in Jefferson's will. And in the 1830 census, she is listed as a free white woman in Charlottesville. They do another census in 1833, a special census, because they're after the Nat Turner Rebellion. They're going around asking free black people if they want to go back to Africa. And they come to her because they're trying to get rid of free blacks. And they go and ask if she wants to go back to Africa. And according to the document there, she says no.
Can you imagine? And just no, someone knocking on your door and going, hey, you've never been there. And you're like remotely African. But would you want to go and live there?
We want to get there. I mean, she might as well go back to Lancaster, which is where her father was from.
Yeah.
And she's listed there as a free Negro. So it sort of shows you the kind of racial, the sort of blurry lines on racial categories. So she's there and dies in 1835. We believe 1835. That's one date that's given. But there's a European traveler who has a travelogue about being in America, and he visits Charlottesville, and he claims to have seen her. He describes her, you know, he's talking about the connection to Jefferson, and said she was old but still very beautiful is the description. So it may have been 1835 or 1837 is the last possible, the two dates that we have for possibly that she was alive at least until 1837, and we don't know that for certain.
But he died in 1826, didn't he? And his death was pretty catastrophic for most of the slaves at Monticello.
Yes, catastrophic. He died deeply in debt, and the enslaved people were sold to pay the debts. Eventually, they lost Monticello a couple of years later. So it all came crashing down after he died because, you know, he was able to get credit as so long as he was alive.
Yeah.
But once he dies, all of those things got called in, and only a handful of people actually managed to avoid being on the auction block. Most of them, the only thing that we're sort of, that's not a good thing, but
yeah.
The only mitigating thing is that most of the people were sold to people in the area. But still, I mean, you think of people having their lives disrupted, separated from families, even if it's, you know, not down to Louisiana or anything like that. It was a catastrophic event. They suffered. It's very often that historians in the past used to talk about the strain that this was on Jefferson and his white family. But it was really the people who were held as property who suffered the most.
Yeah, I mean, there's like family units being split, aren't there, and things that he apparently tried hard to let them live in family units, didn't he? And or so much as they weren't separated and torn apart under at Monticello.
Monticello was a pretty stable place. It's the same people in the same configurations for about 50 years. I mean, with not much change, but that all falls apart once he dies. It was also not typical either, which was also, completely typical. It was not atypical because anytime a person dies, obviously property has to be divided up. Either creditors take their share or siblings take their share. So that's always, a fraught moment for enslaved people upon the death of any person who claimed ownership over them.
Yeah, just I can imagine it's like that sudden uncertainty about whether you're still going to be living with your loved ones way down the line.
Later on, yes. I mean, the most wrenching, if you look at the narratives of enslaved people, it's clear that it wasn't the whip that was the most painful thing to them. It was the separation, never seeing your mother again. And after the end of the Civil War, you saw there in the newspapers, there were ads and so forth that they, people would take out saying, have you seen my daughter or this person? They kept trying to reconnect to one another however they could. And it's been a big, in the United States, family reunions are really big among yeah. African Americans. And it is probably because of the legacy of the kind of separation and the mm-hmm. idea of everybody coming together again every year or every other year to be family is something that's quite important.
The book is fantastic. Congratulations on it. And I'm so excited because you finished just after Jefferson's death, don't you? So I'm excited that you're following the family further on now because there's like Civil War service and just you're going on with the Hemings family, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do this summer.
Yeah. Oh, just bring me an archive, please. I just give anything to be sniffing some dirty old book somewhere right now.
I know, but there'll be a while before that for us, I think.
Absolutely. They've all been really good over here, though, with like the National Archives is just letting you digitally take things for free if it's been scanned. So usually they mm-hmm. charge for that remotely. But in the mid-90s, you wrote, the first book you wrote on this was Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. Now, at this point, pre-DNA evidence, for 150 years, Jefferson's scholars had adamantly sought to, well, to like defend him, in inverted commas, from the insinuation that he had this sexual relationship with one of his slaves and fathered her children. But why do you think it was such an offensive idea? And why did it matter whether people knew the truth about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it mattered because Jefferson is a founding father. And the whole notion of him having children with a person who was not 100% white, a person who was of lower status, the lowest status, and that he would involve himself for that length of time. Do you know, I think if there had been a story about one kid.
One drunken night somewhere.
Yeah, it might have been different. Actually, his principal biographer, Duma Malone, said that in 1981, 82, and he gave an interview for the New York Times, and he says, even after denying it all these years, he said, well, I could see him having sex with her one or two times, but what I can't accept is 38 years. And what?
Oh, thank you for that sweeping judgment of something for which you were not present.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, one or two times could be one or two kids, right? Yep. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to get pregnant, a young woman pregnant. And the fact that he could say it wouldn't, that wouldn't be possible. But the thing that bothered him was the idea that he would carry on like this for a long time. A long period of time. So I think it was...
Sounds like that man thing where, well, I only cheated once, so it doesn't
count. Yeah. Doesn't count.
Where all women go, no.
No, wrong on the facts, wrong on the law. I think it changed the image of a founding father, and it changed the image of America, because it says that America is not a white country. I mean, that from the very beginning, there were these entanglements that you have to pay attention to enslaved people. When the DNA reports came back, I fielded interviews, questions from all over the world. And one, this is actually an American person, said to me, I never thought of Jefferson as a slaveholder until now. And I thought, that's interesting.
I just like that's airbrushed that bit out of my mind.
Yeah, but it's thinking about the idea of a person, you know, body to body contact, dealing with someone in that way. Before you could put enslaved people off somewhere. Those are the people who are down off in the fields. We don't have to pay any attention to them. This was a person who had children who were sort of running around his house. And you have to think about this.
While he was president.
Yeah, and you have to think about this in a way that people had not before. So I think that was part of the reason for it. Why I thought it was important was not because I wanted to prove that they had kids together. What was important to me was the sort of double standard for looking at the evidence. I was concerned about the process, that somehow the people who were enslaved were treated as if they were the suspect people and they were the untrustworthy people. and people who held other people in bondage were above reproach. So I had bodies of evidence on from the side that saying he didn't do it, quoting members of his family, evidence that was riddled with falsehoods and things that they had to have known were not true, and yet they were presented as if they were authoritative. On the other side, the testimony, I could use the word, of enslaved people was treated as presumptively untrustworthy. And I thought that that's
history.
I thought, you know, this is more important than just Tom and Sally. This is, how do you write about history? How do you talk about Black people today?
You have to apply the same rules to everybody if you're a historian, don't you? You can't.
Exactly. And I thought it spilled over into the way African Americans have been treated throughout history. The notion that our words, you know, even if people believe us, they can't say they believe us because it would violate some sort of not understanding.
It's like you're talking ill of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So that's really what I wanted to try to address is how do you decide who is trustworthy and who should be believed in this situation? And it's sort of a reverse of what you typically think. You typically pay attention to victims, right? You don't say, except I suppose rape victims, maybe you're not that's one category of people who are very often not believed at the very beginning. And we're sort of trying to come out of that, but it's about weighing evidence is what I really wanted to get at.
Mm. I mean, so DNA testing did prove a link, and this was all going on. So for people over here, it was like, just as they were doing all that testing on the Russian imperial family at the foot of that mine shaft in Siberia. So basically as soon as it was possible, they were doing the DNA testing on surviving through Jefferson's children with his wife and through some of Sally Hemings's children, weren't they? And there is a match. So why are some people still saying that, I mean, you said that the consensus now is that everybody believes it, but why is there some people still not?
Well, because they don't like the idea. I mean, what they're saying is they've sort of pulled up other possible candidates, people who have never been mentioned before, and which I predicted that this was going to happen, that they would try to find somebody else. People just don't really want to believe that he was involved in this situation. And so,
are they trying to find another Jefferson that could have been responsible for that DNA?
Oh yes, they're trying to find, yeah, that's the idea, is to find. But the problem is the people that they keep coming up with, they come up with different people. There's no documentary evidence. I mean, you know, it's not even a historical question because there's nothing from the contemporary time that suggests that this is true. We can't link, they never offer any evidence of any kind of link to, you know, to people, other people other than Sally Hemings. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book is that Jefferson is at Monticello and away from Monticello, I should say quite a bit during the time that Sally Hemings is having her children. And every time she conceives a child, he has just come home. Mm. And the people that they're saying are the fathers live in the area. So it's as if they cannot get her pregnant unless Jefferson comes home.
I mean, it's like the equivalent in my military history world of the crazies that think Hitler didn't die in the bunker.
Yes.
Like, where you will just grab anything and just say, like, to try and cling to a fallacy.
Yes, and he will be 130 years old, you know, and he's still living somewhere.
He's still in Buenos Aires somewhere.
Buenos Aires someplace. Yeah. And it's like, no. because I think people like mysteries, too. Yeah. People don't want a mystery solved. There was a famous case in Charlottesville. Not Charlottesville, it seems to be the place for this. Anastasia, a woman who claimed to be the long lost daughter of, you know, the czars. And I don't think, maybe there are probably still people who don't accept that they found them. They eventually found them. And
it's because there may be there's nothing there for the boy, and there's a spare tooth, but I think it's Marie. Is there nothing there of the third daughter, or not enough? Got to cling on to a bit of the mystery. What we've got, so just categorically, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation has said they, as far as they are concerned, it is settled, and he was the father of her known children. Yeah. And they did an exhibit on her, didn't they, at Monticello? Yeah.
It's still there. There's a tour. There's a Hemings family tour now, and it's a regular part of the presentation. And they have come to grips with this and moved on to other things.
So you've got a similar thing happening with Jefferson statues. And I have to ask you this because I've just dealt with a wealth of crazies with my surname about Winston Churchill in the last couple of weeks, because that was the statues here. So now I think it's New York. I don't know if anywhere else is now, I haven't been following it, has decided that they're going to evaluate. I think Jefferson is one of the statues. When he wrote that men had a right to liberty in 1776, he owned more than 100 slaves. And that is the only thing people are going to use on their tagline, is it, as an argument? So as someone who has written extensively on the man, how should Americans rectify this in the present day? And as an African-American woman, do you agree with the statue bashing, as we've termed it on History Hack?
Statue bashing. I've said this publicly and I've written about this. I think that the founders are separate from the Confederates. I don't think that they should be put into the same category as Confederate statues. And it depends on where they are. You know, if members of the community don't want a particular statue in a particular place, that, you know, that's okay. But I don't think that as a matter of course they should be taken down, because, and the contributions are too great, too much a part, integral part of American history to pretend that he wasn't important. And what you do is what people are doing now is to talk fully about the entire legacy, not just the good things, but the things that are not good.
It's all about context, isn't it? Which is what all of this screeching lacks, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, I think right now people are excited about the possibility of change, about some things that are really important, whether it's reforming police activity, whatever, those kinds of things, equity in other places, inequality. People are concerned about this, and this is sort of a symbol of that in a way, a way where people think that they could have something concrete done, but the thing that's done is not really transformative.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that, as I said, the Confederates, that never made any sense to us. I mean, to me, for us to put up statues to someone who lost the war, that, who tried to destroy the United States, that was clearly about white supremacy and the South shall rise again and that kind of lost cause stuff. The founders are different. We just have to grapple with our troublesome founders.
And the fact that these men weren't perfect, they didn't think they were perfect, and we shouldn't be judging them on a scale of whether or not they were perfect. They did amazing things, and they did things that we now see as abhorrent or not of like a morality that is dubious. And I don't think that mean we don't think on History Hack that means you have to go around pulling their statues down. It just means you need to educate people better, like you say, tell them the whole story.
Yeah, and particularly if it's a person who has contributed a lot. Some of these people who are up, you can't kind of figure out why are they there. You know, they're not in the same category as a George Washington, for which we don't have a country if he didn't do what he did. I mean, he was able to command the respect of 13 colonies and have them come together. He was the glue that held them together. And you can't pretend that he didn't do something good, something momentous. And the fact that you have a statue up doesn't mean that you agree with every single thing that he said or the way he lived his life. But it does mean that we have to talk about the really complicated origins of this country. Mm-hmm. Slavery, Indian removal, those kinds of things have to be on the table. And I know that there will be people who want to just honor them and say, you know, we don't talk about those things, but this is an opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to us all about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and their story and the wider context of it. It's been brilliant.
Oh, thanks a lot. I've had a good time.
Oh, thanks very much. Join us tomorrow when our African American History Week continues with Tim Madigan. Tim's a journalist, but he also wrote a book called The Burning, which is about the Tulsa Massacre in 1921. If you've seen the film The Watchmen, the opening scenes are based on his book. This is an event that I vaguely knew in my head had happened, but I had absolutely no idea just how shocking it was until he sat down with us and talked us through what actually happened in the city at that time. Make sure you don't miss it, because I think if you want to understand what is happening in America today, you need to understand events like this. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.